Welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
And a lot of times we feel in our lives that we are running. We are running, we are running, we are running. There's a great show, a great movie, a great book by Stephen King, The Running Man, where he just has to run and run and run. The Fugitive, great Harrison Ford movie, running, running, running. And this is a common theme in our lives. This is a common idea in our world today. That if we don't run, if we don't go, if we don't keep moving, if we stand still, we will falter. We will be destroyed. Now, there's a kind of running that makes us feel alive. We get on that treadmill, or I'm not a runner, so I'm not going to be on a treadmill unless I'm walking. But maybe some of you are runners and you get up and there's that morning jog feel, or a late night run after work, something to just drain that strength, that stress off of you. But we might run in a race, or we might run to catch a train or a plane, or we might run because we just have to. There's a running that feels good, and there's a running that feels like fleeing. The kind where you're not sure what you're running towards, it's just that you're running away from something. Something's pursuing you, something's trying to catch you, and if you don't run, then you might be caught. And you're so desperate to get away from that world that's behind you that you run, lest it catches you. And Elijah knows this kind of running. He's familiar with it. And our story today comes from 1 Kings. And the story of Elijah is, it's often comical, the things that this guy gets himself into. He's one of those prophets that you just, bless his heart, you know, the things that he can come up with on his own, the things that he sees. Elijah runs in 1 Kings 19. He has just called down fire from heaven. He's ended a 3-year drought, and he's slaughtered 450 prophets of Baal. That's a good day at the office for a prophet. You know, that's a good, when you piece them all together, that looks good. And now he has one threat from the queen, from Queen Jezebel, and he's collapsed under a broom tree in the middle of the desert, asking God to let him die. Let's read 1 Kings 19 together. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with a sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." And then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. And he asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, "Get up and eat, or the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank, and then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. At that place, he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I have been very zealous for you for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away. Will you pray with me? Father God, as we come into your presence this morning, we have seen your word, we've heard your word, and now just let it be illuminated in our hearts. Help us to be people who are listening and seeing and seeking after you. In your Son we pray, amen. Elijah was afraid and fled for his life. He said, I have had enough, Lord. This is it. This is the end. Take my life. Here's the question that runs through this entire passage, though. Why does he run? He's just had the greatest victory of his prophecy. He's just slaughtered the unknown prophets of Baal. He's seen the fire come down from heaven. The things that he promised that would happen did happen. The Lord is there with him. He is a powerful man, and yet he runs. He's a funny little guy, isn't he, Elijah? Because just one chapter earlier, he's standing there on the Mount Carmel, the showdown. It's a great scene. I wish we could read it all, but it's like 60 verses. So you'll have to read it this afternoon because you're not busy watching basketball at all. And so Jezebel hears of this. You've slaughtered all of my prophets. So guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to seek your life as well. That's it. One threat. Elijah stared down 450 enemies, 850 prophets in total, and one threat sends him running to the desert. Why does a prophet who just saw fire fall from heaven collapse under a desert bush? This victory depleted him. This victory exhausted him. Triumph exhausted him. And when you're empty, even a manageable threat feels insurmountable. You cannot fight battles as an empty person. And whether we're being depleted by the world around us, our family, our jobs, some emotional distress that's going on, every time we take ourselves into that place, there is a need to be filled again. You cannot pour from an empty cup. And Elijah's empty. This is a big performance for him. This is a big get. Elijah was afraid and fled for his life. I've had enough, Lord. Take my life. He's running from death, but then is asking for death. He's fleeing danger, but then he's pursuing oblivion. And this is the logic of despair. This is the logic of an empty heart, of a person who has nowhere to go. It isn't rational. It's holding these two opposing impulses at once. I don't want to die, so I run, but I can't keep living like this, so I quit. And this is the body giving up. This is the mind giving up. The emotional state giving up. This is our faith leaving us. Despair doesn't usually show up in the middle of the battle, by the way. It shows up after. The adrenaline fades, the crowds go home, when you're alone with the cost of what it took you to survive. And so Elijah isn't running toward anything, right? He's running from something. He's running away. And that kind of running doesn't lead to refuge. It doesn't lead to the things that we think it might. If I can just get out of here, he says. He's not running toward something. He's running from something. And it leads to, of all things, a broom tree. A little scraggly bush in the middle of the desert that offers really almost no shade at all, a place that barely qualifies as shelter. And these are the places that we take ourselves to, by the way. We can rest in God. We can rest in his love and his presence and his endurance and his grace and his compassion. And we say, no, I'm too empty. I must run from this thing. And then what are we left with? The shade of the broom tree. In that moment, in that place, we don't get good quality rest. We're into the wilderness now. We've driven ourselves there because we've been running from something that took us into the wilderness. And that's what our despair does. It takes us not to safety, but to the place where we collapse because now we have nowhere else to go. We've backed ourselves into a corner. We've found the first harbor that's been safe. There's, again, I'm not a runner, but there is a phenomenon in marathon running called hitting the wall. You're probably familiar with this idea. It happens around mile 20, and your muscles, everything that's been stored in your muscles has been depleted. And so your body starts burning fat instead of carbs. Your brain gets a little foggy. Your legs feel really heavy like concrete. And here's the strange thing, though. The wall doesn't hit during the hardest part of your run. It hits after. After you've climbed the hills, after you've maintained your pace, after you've done everything right. The collapse comes not because you've failed, but because you've succeeded too long without rest. Gosh, I don't have to be a marathon runner to experience that though, right? I feel like it's that new movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, one battle after another. It's just every day I wake up and it's a new battle, it's a new thing. Little fires everywhere that I've got to put out. This is the human condition. This is what we feel. And we cannot maintain that. Or we collapse under that pressure. Elijah didn't collapse on Mount Carmel when those 850 prophets were staring at him. He collapsed after, when the fire had fallen, when the rain had come, when the victory was complete. Because the body and soul can only run on adrenaline for so long. Eventually you hit the wall, and when you do, even a threat you could have handled yesterday feels impossible. The danger for people of faith isn't that we'll quit in the middle of the battle, it's that we'll collapse after we win because we never learned to rest in between the fights. In fact, military chaplains will tell you that some of the hardest cases they've seen aren't soldiers in active combat. They're soldiers who have come home and attempted to adjust to life. In the field, adrenaline keeps you sharp. It keeps you moving. The mission keeps you focused. The danger keeps you alert. But a body that's on alert 24/7 is eventually going to fray and collapse. And when you come home, when that external threat is gone, that's when the collapse happens. PTSD, depression, substance abuse, divorce, because your nervous system was running so high that it doesn't know how to power down. And so any threat that shows up, we go on high alert again. And when it does try and shut down, everything that you suppressed in order to survive comes flooding in. Elijah wasn't running from Jezebel. He was running from this little threat that he could no longer handle. It wasn't about Jezebel. It was, I don't have anything else to give. I don't have anything else to give. We'll talk about that in a minute. Henry Nguyen says this, without solitude, it is virtually impossible to live a spiritual life. We do not take the spiritual life seriously if we do not set aside some time to be with God and listen to him. Nguyen wrote extensively about this phenomenon, this post-ministry collapse that he himself experienced, the exhaustion of living for applause, the depletion of performing spirituality. His work on solitude is born from his own broom tree moments. He wasn't immune to the collapse. Elijah wasn't immune to the collapse. Elijah needed solitude, not isolation. Elijah needed rest, not escape. And when we can learn the difference between those two things, rest and escape, that's when our body can really heal. Because I feel like a lot of times we're using our rest as an escape, or we're using other things in our lives as an escape when really we should be resting. Elijah is fleeing from Jezebel. It's an external threat, but look at this also. He is fleeing from his calling, what God has called him to do. He's not pursuing God. He's not running toward the mountain, toward the altar, toward the place where fire fell. He's just running away. And when all you're doing is fleeing, you end up under a broom tree asking to die. Just take me now, God. I can't do this anymore. In the Negev wilderness, a broom tree is that small desert shrub. It's not impressive. And if you're stuck under a broom tree in the desert, it's because you have nowhere else to go. This is the geography of desperation. What are you running from right now? And is your running taking you toward God, or is it taking you just away from pain? These are important things to remember. These are important things to know. I'm running from my past, not necessarily running toward God. We want to be a community that runs toward God. We want to be a community that pursues God, not tries to outrun our past, not tries to outrun our sin, but to stay in the amazing shelter of God. And so we need to start practicing that Sabbath pause, that Sabbath rest. We need to stop before we collapse. We need to stop and rest, not just escape, but run toward God in those moments. You have a victory, you have a defeat. Put it into your calendar. 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. I just need to stop and I need to breathe. I need to slow down. You could even pray in that time. Take it to God instead of trying to outrun those problems by yourself. Elijah says, I'm no better than my ancestors. What's that supposed to mean? No better than your ancestors? This is expectation. This is comparison. This is, I was supposed to be the one to fix this. I am supposed to be better. I wish that I had more power and control. This is such a strange statement. Elijah had done what no prophet before him had done, called down the fire from heaven and ended a national drought and turned the people back to God, at least for a moment. And so by any measure, he is exceptional. His name is in the Bible. I mean, you got to be pretty good to have your name in the Bible, right? But I'm going to tell you this. He wanted more. He expected to be better. And when he wasn't, he was disappointed. He expected to be the one who turned Israel back to God permanently. He expected his faithfulness to produce lasting fruit. He expected that after Mount Carmel, everything would change. But Jezebel's truth, the queen of their nation, says, oh no, 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 now I'm hunting you. Nothing has changed. The victory was real, but it wasn't final. And Ahab is still king, and Jezebel is still in power, and people will bow to Baal again. And that gap between expectation and reality is the thing that crushes us the most. Here's what I thought marriage would be like. Here's what I thought my family would be like. Here's what I thought this thing would be like. And it's so far away from my expectations that the reality is crushing me. So Elijah wasn't just pursuing obedience. He was trying to pursue his own expectations. He was trying to pursue his own significance, something that outlasts him, the kind that makes him better than those who came before him. And when that pursuit collapsed, despair moved in. Because here's the thing about unspoken expectations and our expectations, especially about other people around us, they are unspoken, aren't they? They always are going to set us up for collapse. When we have a problem, when we have an argument, when we have a situation with another person, it's almost always unexpressed expectations. I thought you were going to do this. I thought you were going to be there for me when I needed you. I thought this thing of you. Really? You didn't say anything about that to me. How am I supposed to know if we don't talk about this? I thought you would turn in that project on time. I thought you were going to call that guy. I thought that you would take care of that. I'm sorry. But the reality is, we can't control those around us if we're not going to be responsible for sharing our expectations with them. And we do the same thing with God, don't we? I thought you were going to heal this person. I thought you were going to give me a better job. I thought that you were going to do this. I thought that you were going to do that. And then people say, that's it, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. They walk away from their faith because their expectations of who they think God is doesn't meet the reality. See, they were pursuing something else rather than obedience. They were pursuing expectations rather than obedience. And this is why the disciples kept missing Christ in their presence. I thought as Messiah you would come with an army. I thought as Messiah you'd call yourself down from the cross. I thought as Messiah you would bring an end to all of this. And you didn't do that. So where are you now? When we tie our faithfulness to outcomes we can't control, we are just one disappointment away from our own broom tree. If we pray hard enough, my family will heal. If we're faithful long enough, my kids will come back to faith. If we serve sacrificially enough, the church will grow. If we're obedient, consistent enough, life will feel less hard. And we all think this. We think that our faithfulness to this church means that all of a sudden it'll start growing, and that's just not the reality that we live in. If the church were going to grow because I was praying for growth every day, then it would have done it by now. But that's just not the way that it works. My call is not to pray for growth. Your call is not to pray for growth. Your call is to be obedient to the call of God in your life, to remain faithful to God in all the things that you do. That's it. And when we start having our expectations about, oh, this should be happening, or that should be happening, or we should have more people, or we should have a bigger building, or we should have, you know, something else. Me, 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 me. We sound like a bunch of seagulls. Mine, 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 mine. God has called you to be obedient to your position. That's it. He provides everything else. That when we're under the broom tree, he comes and touches us and says, here, I baked you a delicious cake. And I want you to eat all of it, by the way. That's biblical. So if you don't eat this cake, you're going to be struggling. If you don't get healthy, if you don't rest, if you don't listen to what your body, if you don't listen to the boundaries that you've put in place, rest won't happen. A farmer can plant, water, fertilize, and weed, but he cannot make the seed grow. That's up to forces beyond his control. So what do we do here? We plant, we water, we fertilize, we weed, but we have no choice on the seeds. Soil quality, rainfall, temperature, disease, all out of his control. What's in your control? What do you have a hand in doing? Elijah became spiritually checked out, we might say. He's expressed a death wish. He's running from his calling. And God's response? Not a rebuke, not a vision change, not a pep talk. Bread, water, sleep. Get up and eat. Those are the two commands twice in this passage. Get up and eat. God meets the body before he addresses the soul. God gives Elijah what he needs, not what he thinks he deserves. This is stunning that God treats us the same way. Elijah is in full despair, and God doesn't correct his theology. He feeds him and tells him to rest. Have you ever dealt with a child throwing a tantrum before? Not me. Not today, at least. How do you deal with a child in a tantrum? They're yelling and screaming, kicking on the floor, throwing themselves all over the place, throwing things. Do you sit them down and start to tell them what they did wrong? Start to lecture them on their behavior? No. This doesn't work. Let me give you what you need before I give you what you deserve. Let me give you love and comfort and care. Let me give you bread and water and rest so that now we can talk about what comes next. Now we can correct what just happened. We have the energy to do that. God doesn't start with a theological lecture. He starts with bread and water. Elijah is in crisis. He is dehydrated. He's starving. He's sleep deprived. He's in shock. Because despair isn't just a failure of faith. It's a failure of the body to keep carrying what the soul has been asked to bear. And God meets us in our physicality. He knows we are dust. And sometimes the most spiritual thing he can do is feed us. That's why we as a church do community dinners, because sometimes the best thing that we can do for each other is to feed us well. And boy, do we eat well at a community dinner, because it's so important. And people will say, well, don't you do a Bible study? Don't you talk about God? Don't you? No. Food is spiritual. Food is church. It's a way to connect because it brings people together, like God brings people together. And so that's one of our core beliefs here. What unspoken expectation are you carrying that's setting you up for despair? And what do you think faithfulness would produce if it hadn't? Here's a great action step for us in this way. In moments of despair, in moments of feeling overwhelmed, you can do it on a regular basis in the morning, in the evening. You can do it when you're feeling stressed. You can feel it when you're feeling that God is not there. You just do the bread and water prayer. God, give me what I need today. That language, by the way, is from the Lord's Prayer. Give us today our daily bread. That's it. Don't ask for strength. Don't ask for to be taken out of this situation. Don't ask for any of that. Just say, God, give me my daily bread. God, give me my water. Give me the things that I need and nothing more and nothing less. Help me receive grace in the gap between my effort and the outcome. And see what happens. See the ways that God shows up in your life. What are you doing here, Elijah? This is the great question that God asks of his people. What are you doing here? No, really, what are you doing here? Like, that's a question that we have to wrestle with all the time. What are you doing here in this church? What are you doing here in your relationships with people around you? What are you doing here in your job? What are you doing here in your family life? What are you doing here? Now, Elijah gets asked this question because he ran and he went to hide in the cave. Okay, what are you doing in the cave, Elijah? Why does God ask Elijah a question he already knows the answer to? And the interesting part about the answer is not, I was scared and I ran away. He focuses on all of the things that he'd already done. Oh, I was zealous for you. I did all the things that you asked me to. And I didn't get rewarded for that. Mount Horeb, by the way, is Mount Sinai. I just want to poke that pin in there too. Because Moses was marching toward Mount Sinai, wasn't he? 40 years in the desert, 40 days in the desert for Elijah going to Mount Sinai. Oh gosh, the whole world just opens up as soon as we know about it, right? Moses went up the mountain to meet with God, and so Elijah, he goes in the cave. He doesn't want to meet with God. The cave is enclosed. It's dark. It's hidden. It feels like protection, doesn't it? How often do we run to things that feel like protection, but it actually is just becoming a prison for us? Prison is nice and dark and closed off, but it's not for protection. He's not resting in the cave. That's the difference, is he's hiding in it. He's escaped from the thing that's so wrong. I have zealously served the Lord God Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me. Listen to those words. I have been zealous. I'm the only one left. They're trying to kill me. There's no mention of God's presence, no mention of God's provision, no mention of God's promises. Despair has narrowed Elijah's vision so completely that he can't see past his own exhaustion and his own isolation. This is the psychological reality of despair. It distorts our reality. He says, I alone am left, which is not true. So despair often rewrites our reality. Our brain only knows the things that we tell it. Why does exhaustion convince us we're alone? Despair distorts our perception. It makes us believe that we are more alone than we really are. It makes us forget the people who have shown up in our lives. It convinces us that the experience that we're going through is unique and unbearable and not survivable. But here's the truth. Elijah wasn't wrong. Later, God tells him in verse 18, I have 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed to Baal. Elijah isn't lying. He genuinely believes he's alone, but his perception is distorted. He can't see past the nose on his face because he's so wrapped up in himself. And despair will lie to you. It will tell you, you're the only one trying. No one understands. You are abandoned. It's all on you. There's a psychological phenomenon called the spotlight effect. And it's the belief that everyone is watching you, judging you, noticing your failures. But there is also an inverse psychological effect called the soundproof booth. The belief that no one sees you, that you're invisible, you're alone, you're forgotten. And despair creates this soundproof booth around you. You can see people moving on the outside, but you can't hear them. You can't feel their presence. You convince yourself they're not really there. Or if they are there, they just don't care. That Elijah's in that booth. He's in that place where he's convinced that he's the only one left. Frederick Buechner has this incredible quote. It was a great quote of my friend Stacy. He writes, "Here is the world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Don't be afraid." That is the paradox of our faith, that we live in a world where both beauty and terror coexist. And God calls us to stay present to both. Elijah wanted the beautiful without the terrible. He wanted Mount Carmel without Jezebel. But God is inviting him to stay in the calling even when it's hard. And the cave offers escape, but God offers presence and protection and safety. By the way, the last thing here. The cave isn't where God is, right? The cave is where Elijah is hiding from God, and God goes to him there. It's an invitation to us all. In those moments of hiding, in those moments of escape, and he comes and he says, "What are you doing here? And I was hiding from you, and yet you still found me." God isn't in those places we escape to, but he comes and he finds us there because he's not done with us. Are we running from something or are we running toward someone?